This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, April 29th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. In 2006, the activist Tarana Burke created a website for an anti-sexual violence project she called Me Too. 11 years later, when allegations of sexual misconduct against Harvey Weinstein set off reactions around the world over these issues, Burke's project became a viral hashtag that defined a massive cultural shift. But a year after the Weinstein story broke, Burke, in a TED Talk, lamented the difficulties in keeping the movement going.
The reality is, after soldiering through the Supreme Court nomination process and attacks from the White House, gross mischaracterizations, internet trolls, and the rallies and marches and heart-wrenching testimonies, I'm faced with my own hard truth. I am numb. And I'm not surprised.
In the years since Burke's speech, the Me Too movement has had a number of victories, legal and cultural, but the forces that discouraged her continue. Last week, The New Yorker's Alexandra Schwartz wrote about Blake Bailey, whose recent best-selling biography of Philip Roth has been taken out of print 3 years after his publisher received accusations that Bailey had committed sexual assault. I'm joined by Alex Schwartz and Jane Mayer, who has reported on several sexual misconduct cases involving politicians. We'll discuss the politics of Me Too and what the Blake Bailey case tells us about the state of the movement. Thank you both for jumping into this hornet's nest.
Great to be with you.
Glad to be here.
Jane, let's start with you. As I was just saying, the Me Too movement has had setbacks along with its successes. How would you characterize the impact it's had in this country over the past nearly 5 years?
Gosh, that's a big question. I think the impact has been tremendous, and it may be difficult to sort of calculate exactly, but where it's impacted most is really in the sort of sophisticated cosmopolitan circles, and certainly the political world. I'm not sure that it's really reached to sort of everyday workplaces all across the country. I worry that in some ways it's kind of an issue that the chattering classes are preoccupying themselves with without looking more broadly at where in some parts of this country, it's a much bigger problem that has yet to be addressed. I mean, I wrote a piece about poultry workers out in the Eastern Shore of Delaware, and it's such a serious issue of sexual harassment in those workplaces, and nobody's coming to the women's aid, or and the consciousness has not been raised there. But anyway, it's become a tremendous force, I think, and a real movement both in this country and globally.
Yes, so that's where I want to turn to you, Alex. Could you describe this most recent conflagration? I mean, Blake Bailey is a very well-known and until now highly respected biographer. He's the author of this recent biography of Philip Roth. What has happened?
Yeah, I mean, it's been truly head-spinning, and I did an event with him around the Roth biography just a couple of weeks ago when he was still a highly respected figure. So this has happened very fast, but essentially what we now know is that in 2018, a publishing executive, although at the time she was anonymous, Valentina Rice, wrote to the head of Norton, which was under contract to publish Blake Bailey's biography of Philip Roth. At that time, it was already well underway. And she wrote with an allegation that Bailey had raped her a few years before, I believe in 2015. She was inspired by the Me Too movement, and I think felt that with all these dams breaking and women speaking up about assault and harassment, she could finally do the same. And her claim, which was sent anonymously, was forwarded by the publishing house to Bailey, who then responded to the anonymous email to deny the allegation and to ask the sender not to make the allegation public, We don't know what else Norton did. It seems that they did precious little. They did not respond to Valentina Rice directly or to her under her pseudonym directly. And this has now become public in a major way, also alongside allegations that date back years that Blake Bailey groomed students of his when he was a teacher in New Orleans at a girls' school, and that he was grooming students for sex when they reached a legal age, and also that he had raped a former student when she was in her 20s and he was in his 30s. Now, Bailey has denied all of the accusations against him. In any case, Norton has taken his memoir and his biography of Roth out of print.
Let's just go back for a second to your interview with Bailey, because you had obviously read the book, and I think I'm being fair in saying that you weren't one of its great admirers. How did the interview go?
Yeah, you know, I read the book in advance of the interview. There had been a few very strong negative reviews in the New Republic and in the New York Times from Laura Marsh and Pearl Sagal, among others, who had been really critical of the book and of its treatment of women, obviously a major question in Roth's life. And one question for any reader of the book was, how much of this is Roth and how much of this is the perspective of the writer? Those are really tangled questions. For me, they've only gotten more tangled since the news about Bailey broke. But, you know, I felt that there was a lot that was also quite interesting in the book. Roth is a major literary figure to grapple with, for me, certainly. And I was really curious about how Bailey had gone about writing the book, researching the book, and that was the focus of my conversation with him. You know, do I regret not having pressed him harder on his own attitudes towards women? Absolutely. I'm pretty floored by what we've learned in the past week.
It seems to me that when you're looking back over this incident, that it should have been Norton who pressed him about his attitudes towards women in the first place.
Absolutely.
That first of all, the fact that Roth chose this biographer, and he chose this biographer, if you listen to what Bailey says, partly because Bailey shared with him a point of view about women. He got hired after, apparently, Roth said to Bailey, that he could have had sex with Ally McGraw, who famously played the female role in Goodbye Columbus. And Bailey, the would-be biographer, was kind of being interviewed for the job, and he said, "Oh man, why didn't you? You should have." At which point Roth said, "Well, you're hired." And from the start, you would think if there had been sort of women editors paying close attention, they might have thought a little bit about what a problem this presents for a biographer of Roth, who, you know, has famously been accused of misogyny during his life. You know, what kind of person do you trust to tell that story? And what kind of perspective does the person bring to it? And it seems like they didn't ask those questions. And then I would continue to be somewhat critical of Norton for when they did get this allegation that reached them of rape. I think it's amazing and a real breach that they took this allegation and they sent it to the person that the woman was accusing without asking the accuser about that, which tipped off the author and then had him begin to try to suppress the story by asking her not to talk. These things, to me, they suggest that Norton was not thinking. It was not conscious of all the issues that the Me Too movement brings. And then finally, in the end, Norton kind of reacts by canceling the book in its way. But it, by then, it's kind of too late and it's failed to ask the questions it should have in the first place, maybe.
Jane, I totally agree with you. I think there's so many questions that are raised by Norton's behavior. The most recent question is, who is really served by this decision to cancel the Roth biography? I don't have an answer to that question. I'm not sure what remedy there is in canceling the book, aside from Norton just sort of treating it like a hot potato to get it off its hands. You know, and I think this gets back to one of the really complicated questions about Me Too, which is, what should private employers, private workplaces do in the context of allegations of harassment, and in this case, of rape? You know, in Norton's case, to forward an allegation to the accused, first of all, had a tangible chilling effect on the allegation. We know that the victim also went to the Times, which contacted her, and then she withdrew her interest in pursuing in having the Times pursue her story. I think she clearly got freaked out. So when you don't have an actual investigation into these claims, there aren't just consequences for the accused, there are consequences for the victim as well. And this whole thing to me speaks of Norton trying to pass the ball at every stage, and now it's trying to do it in a major way.
I mean, I agree with you. And I think that, you know, when Dorothy was asking what stage are we at with the Me Too movement, I think what it's highlighting is a kind of a lack of process to know how to deal with these accusations in a satisfying and fair and a just and way. I mean, and so, you know, traditionally it was left to law enforcement, and as we know that a lot of the law enforcement community swept these things under the rug. There were a lot of, you know, HR departments are kind of inadequate for dealing with it in many cases. And I think there is I have felt a legitimate worry about sort of kind of mob justice that is, you know, trial by Twitter. Where there's not an effort to try to really get evidence and dig in and see what the facts are. The process is what's missing at this point and trying to catch up.
And Jane, I want just to broaden out the discussion a little bit. So Norton has permanently taken the Roth biography and his memoir, Bailey's memoir, The Splendid Things We Planned, out of print. And almost concurrently, hundreds of staff at Simon & Schuster called on the company to cancel its plans to publish books by Mike Pence. So this has been already described as cancel culture. And the CEO of Simon & Schuster, Jonathan Karp, made a statement to his staff saying, "We come to work each day to publish, not to cancel, which is the most extreme decision a publisher can make and one that runs counter to the very core of our mission, to publish a diversity of voices and perspectives." So what about that?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, what Karp is articulating is kind of a noble, you know, liberal philosophy that, you know, we believe in pluralism, we believe in debate, democracy requires many points of view. And, you know, I think in many ways that's laudable, but at the same time, I think that it's a little disingenuous if you look back. Because most of these political books are simply mercenary. It's a way for the publishing houses to make money. These are not great literature. They're not even interesting arguments for the most part. So, I mean, that, you know, it might have been more honest to say, you know, this is a great revenue stream and we're not going to cancel that.
Yeah.
But and at the same time, I also think it's really important for people who are up in arms about this being cancel culture, who are quoted, particularly in the New York Times story, there was somebody from the Regnery Press, which is the, you know, the right wing press, saying, you know, this is terrible. This is so illiberal. Take a look at what Regnery publishes. The right wing has its own sort of cottage industry of publishing that never publishes liberal voices. So they're really not, they have no standing to complain about this situation as far as I'm concerned.
So Alex, this supposed threat of cancel culture, it does seem to be a pretty effective tool to combat social justice movements like Me Too. Poll after poll show that people are genuinely concerned about some kind of, you know, so-called woke mob running amok through our culture. And then many people take to Twitter to say so. Is there anything to that concern?
Well, I think it's certainly true that public pressure can have a major effect. I mean, it is easier than ever to express pressure and for people to band together and to create pressure. And I think what we're seeing now is a kind of, we may be at some sort of turning point where a lot of what public pressure is revealing is the total lack of process at many institutions for dealing with allegations of rape and harassment and assault and everything in this category. I mean, one thing, just to come back to Norton for a second, one thing that's really interesting to me about the Norton case is that Norton took its decision before there was a public pressure campaign. I'm sure they were anticipating there was going to be one, and there may very well have been one. But that was sort of, I think that just kind of showed us that when pressure, which can be really useful as a political tool, comes in and pushes against a system that doesn't really have a way of weighing claims, we have a problem. And I also really think it's important to remember that This is a problem for victims and for people bringing accusations. It's not just a problem for the accused, because it means that their accusations can't be heard. They can't be listened to seriously. And it, for a lot of people, can delegitimize those accusations when what we really need to do is to actually listen to them and take them seriously.
You know, I mean, I have been certainly supporting women's need and right to push back against sexual harassment, at least since going back to the Anita Hill period, about whom I wrote a book. But I also think, as someone who's written a lot about civil liberties, that it's important that there be some kind of fairness in the process. And I tried to bring up some of these questions in a piece about Al Franken, the former senator from Minnesota. In that case, there were instant calls for him to resign before there was any kind of evidence weighed. There were just plain accusations made against him online. And there were a number of them, enough so that it seemed suspicious. But just the same, there was a process that could have taken place in the Senate. They actually are one of the few workplaces that have a sort of the ability to have a kind of, they have an ethics committee that holds trials. And he wanted to go ahead and have that kind of process, but he was really, really pretty much forced out by his peers and had to resign. I mean, you could say that he could have fought it harder, but at any rate, there was a tremendous pressure for him to resign, and he did. And I think that's a shame, because as somebody who has covered a lot of these cases, they take time to understand what the facts are. There are two sides to, at least, to every story, sometimes many sides to stories. And you really need to dig in to try to get the records, the facts, to figure out what happened. Something either did happen or it didn't happen. And you can get there, but it takes more time than a tweet, I think.
So, Jane, you know, you might contrast the Franken case with the more recent case of New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, who in the past few months has been pretty credibly accused by multiple women of misconduct, yet he has said repeatedly he's not going anywhere. Does his stance speak to the change in how the public is responding to Me Too cases these days, or maybe a change in how the accused responds?
Well, I think we've begun to see more pushback maybe from some of the accused. But I mean, the thing about the Cuomo situation that is in some ways salutary development is that there is a process. I mean, you have Letitia James actually has appointed two independent investigators who are both well thought of, who are sort of interviewing the various potential witnesses and sorting through the evidence. So, I mean, that's a case where there is a process, and I think that's progress.
It's been clear from the start of Me Too that younger and older women see these debates somewhat differently. And Jane and I have daughters around your age, Alex. And so maybe, Jane, you could start by talking a little bit about this generation gap.
I mean, I could certainly see it in when I wrote about Al Franken, and I was accused of having, you know, let down the sisterhood in many ways. By some people were absolutely outraged that I would question his accusers. To me, that's just what reporters do. That's my job, and you know, so no apologies from me on this. But I could see that. There, with the younger generation, the idea that you need to listen to women often sort of bleeds into believe the women just automatically. And that is certainly, I think maybe that's for the older generation is a line that we haven't quite accepted.
And also I would say, before I turn to you, Alex, is so many women of our generation were harassed, sexually harassed in the workplace, and our generation's response was just to kind of suck it up and keep going, because that was considered just something you had to put up with. So that, of course, is no longer the case. And I would say that's a good development. Okay, Alex.
Yeah, I think so much of what has characterized my generation's response is at the base, this sense of real indignation that this is still going on. I mean, my generation was raised by mothers who were sort of the first American generation of women who could absolutely expect to enter the workplace. And those mothers, I think a lot of them, mine included, gave me a real sense of, oh, girls are equal to boys, women can do anything. So when you come into a world where you really are expecting equality and are met with so many barriers, it's infuriating, it's maddening, and I think this there's an anger that wells up and explodes. I also think, you know, we now are almost 4 years, I think, into Me Too, and there is more of a complexity to the way that I have started to think about it. I think Jane is really right to point to the slogan, Believe Women, which feels really empowering and exciting until you look back at American history and you look back at white women's accusations against black men. It's not a great blanket idea. For me, the goal is to elevate women's voices so that we can have our voices heard on the same plane as men's. And that's a really elusive goal we're finding, but I think we have to still hold to it.
You know, I agree. I mean, I have to say I have great admiration for Alex's generation for not accepting the indignities that maybe didn't rise to the level of being, you know, full-fledged rape or assault, but or maybe even not full-fledged sexual harassment in the workplace. But there's really no reason that women in the workplace need to put up with all the junk that we put up with, Dorothy. And yeah. I'm glad that the younger generation is saying, forget it. We're not going to tolerate that. And so I sort of say, you know, hats off to them for continuing to push, because you have to push. That's one thing that our generation certainly saw.
Absolutely. And it's unpleasant to get the pushback, as we've discussed. Jane, I want to just end by talking about the effects the Me Too movement has begun to have a little bit after, you know, what we've seen in the United States, the effects it's begun to have around the world, everywhere from France to China, where in China, a screenwriter is suing a media anchor for alleged sexual harassment and assault. And the screenwriter has cited the Me Too movement as an inspiration and has said, whether we win or lose the case, it has meaning. That's pretty incredible.
It is incredible. I mean, what we're also seeing in China, though, is that the very few women who have been able to step up and speak out, there's just tremendous blowback against them on social media in China and in other parts of the world. People are trolled, they're doxxed, they're slut-shamed. It's really a blood sport almost. So it's very difficult going in many parts of the world. But, you know, and partly what this to me suggests is that part of what really needs to be done is there need to be more women in authority on the courts, running the businesses, judging these cases and recognizing the seriousness of them. Because what you've got now are the women crying out in the wilderness kind of and looking for support from authorities. And in many countries, including China, the authorities are still almost all male.
Yeah, it's just yesterday I was interviewing Vanessa Springora, who is a French writer who's written a really extraordinary book called Consent, which is a memoir of her adolescence when she was the 13, 14, and 15-year-old lover of a 50-year-old self-admitted pedophile writer in France, a writer who was really praised and upheld by the French literary establishment, who knew all about his proclivities because he wrote about them. She's written this memoir about realizing that she was his victim. And it's quite an amazing book. And she was saying that when she does interviews, even in Europe, in Northern Europe, in Scandinavia, people say to her, well, why is France so behind the times? Why has France upheld this pedophile and people like him and abusers like him for so many years? Why has it taken so long for people like you to speak out? And when she speaks to people in Spain and Portugal, in Southern Europe, they say, wow, you're so ahead of us. So it's all relative. And it you know, it's both sobering to see how long progress can take, I think. But it's also really encouraging when you do see people beginning to write their books, to tell their stories, to go public.
Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Great to be with you.
Jane Mayer is The New Yorker's chief Washington correspondent. Her books include Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. Alexandra Schwartz is a staff writer at The New Yorker. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.